In U.S. working forests, or forest land carefully managed to provide a steady, renewable supply of wood for daily use, more than 1 billion trees are planted every year, and forestry experts protect and manage hundreds of millions of acres. Working forests have been sustainably managed for decades. How? It's simple. They plant more trees than they harvest. Learn more at workingforestsinitiative.com.
Support for this show comes from Sylvan Learning. When children love learning, they can tackle any challenge life throws at them. Sylvan's Insight Assessment can help you determine if your child is ready for what's ahead. It can also identify gaps in learning and point out areas that could be of concern for your child so they can tackle what's to come. And right now, it's the best price of the year at $29. Go to sylvan29.com to learn more and get your child's assessment for only $29. That's sylvan29.com.
It's perfectly possible and has always been possible to be extremely pro-Zionist and anti-Semitic. But think about it. If you have Jews that you don't want to live in your country, the idea of them having their own country is an extremely interesting idea.
Hello, welcome to the Ezra Klein Show on the Vox Media Podcast Network. This is a strange and honestly unsettling time to be Jewish in America. We just saw in the synagogue shooting the deadliest act of anti-Semitic violence in American history. There has been an emboldening of anti-Semitism in this country. I don't think Donald Trump himself is anti-Semitic. I say that in this episode. But there is much in his movement and in the things he has done or more importantly not done that seems to have emboldened anti-Semites. All of us who are journalists who write about these issues and are on social media get flooded with anti-Semitic commentary in ways that we didn't used to. And at the same time, Israel has become a very different place. It's become a much more illiberal place. The peace movement there has very much collapsed. The rise of politicians like Avigdor Lieberman, the right-wing lurch of Benjamin Netanyahu, it's made that space also feel unfriendly. It's made that space also feel like something going in a direction I can't support. So this is a podcast about something that I've been feeling and struggling with, which is the vulnerable feeling of being a liberal Jew in America right now, a Jew at a time when you're reminded that anti-Semitism, as has been said before, can be a very light sleeper, including here. And at the same time, you see other spaces in Jewry going in a very different direction from your values. I have found it to be a very uncomfortable place to be in. I've found it's made me reflect on my own Jewish identity and what it means to me and how it makes me feel and what parts I've taken for granted and what parts maybe I can't take for granted. I wanted to have my friend Peter Beinart on to talk about this. Peter was the editor of The New Republic, is now a professor of journalism and political science at City University of New York. He's a contributor to The Atlantic, a senior columnist at The Forward. He's written books about these issues. He's on CNN a lot. And he's a very brilliant guy and I think a courageous voice in this space. And so I was grateful he was willing to come on and talk about all this with me, both talk about how this has happened, how we've gotten to this place, and also try to talk about what this place really is. What are we feeling? What's real? What's just perception? And what should we make of all of it? So this is a little bit of a difficult episode for me to put out. These are not things I usually talk about that publicly. These are things I used to write about more, and for reasons we'll discuss in here, I've written about less. But it's all very personal to me, and so I was glad to have Peter here to try to work through it. As always, you can email me your thoughts at EzraKleinShow@Vox.com. Here is Peter Beinart. Peter Beinart, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
This is a conversation I've wanted to have with you for some time, but have been honestly a little bit nervous to have because just like talking about being Jewish in this moment is a bit of a fragile thing, or it feels that way to me. Let me start here. Is anti-Semitism rising in America, or does it just feel that way?
I think it probably is. Partly is the problem we don't actually have a consensus definition of what anti-Semitism is. So, for instance, there's one wing of the American Jewish community that says that if you deny Israel's right to exist as a Jewish state, that per se is anti-Semitism. On the Jewish left, people tend to deny that, right? They say that there is a theoretical possibility. I would include myself in that category of people who, even though I myself support a certain kind of Jewish state, who could suggest that, no, you could oppose the existence of a Jewish state and not be an anti-Semite. So part of the problem in figuring out how much anti-Semitism there is we don't have a consensus in the American Jewish community or in the American political debate in general about what anti-Semitism is.
So let me try to use a definition that feels more viscerally true to me, which is, are Jews in America in more danger right now than they've been in recent years?
Yes, I think we probably are. I mean, again, it's worth noting that we're in much, much less danger than the more vulnerable groups that Donald Trump is targeting.
Absolutely.
And we're in much less danger, I would say, than Jews in Europe. Even that danger, I think, has sometimes been hyped, but it's not dangerous to walk down in any American city, by and large, and wearing a kippah, wearing a yarmulke, right? I think in a lot of European cities, that's a much more dicey proposition. But if you compare today to pre-Trump, yeah, I think Trump has helped to bring things up in the surface, not even necessarily directly, but I think in a kind of a bank shot way, that if you go after immigrants, Latino immigrants, some of that blows back onto Jews, even if you don't want it to.
There's something interesting there. So I'm going to table the immigration dimension of this just for a second. So we just had the most murderous anti-Semitic attack on American soil ever a couple weeks ago. Something that, in addition to the horror of that, I was just very personally struck by was just a day or two after it, the synagogue or one of the synagogues I went to when I was a child was vandalized, which had not been what I expected right after that attack, right? I sort of thought there'd be a, I don't want to say a rallying around, but there feels to me, I think the thing that I am picking up on is an emboldening, certainly in Europe, as you say, but then here too. And there's some weird way in which I don't think Donald Trump is personally anti-Semitic, but there is an undeniable way in which the people who are truly anti-Semitic feel emboldened by Donald Trump, feel he is fundamentally on their side. And you've done a lot of writing and thinking on this, so I'm curious why you think that is.
I think that if you're prone to conspiracy theories and you have a fairly narrowly defined definition of what Americanism is, you end up bumping into anti-Semitism in a couple of ways. On the immigration question, the problem that racists have often had, anti-black and anti-Latino racists now, is that they see Latino immigrants as a tremendous menace, but they also see them as inferior. So the question is, if they are so inferior, how are they going to organize themselves to come and bring a caravan and destroy the United States? And that's where Jews come in, because the anti-Semitic stereotype of Jews is different, right? It's them, they're kind of evil, but kind of sinister geniuses in a way. You saw this during segregation. I was kind of researching this for a piece I did recently for The Atlantic. What you saw was that a lot of racists in the South said, blacks couldn't possibly organize the civil rights movement themselves. Who's behind this? The Jewish communists. And I remember being the child of South Africans that was said in apartheid South Africa all the time, that Joe Slovo, the, you know, Yiddish-speaking head of the military wing of the ANC, himself his own, is an amazing story, but he was often portrayed as the guy who must be running things because goodness knows the blacks couldn't be running it themselves. So that's one way in which I think, and you saw this with the Tree of Life shooter, right? He was obsessed with the caravan that Trump and Fox was hyping, but he thought, well, the Jews must be behind the caravan. And I think you see a little bit of a version of that with some of the economic globalist fears as well, right? There's a global economic conspiracy out there. Who's behind this? Well, it certainly can't be normal, good Americans like you and me. Maybe it's these shadowy Jewish figures. And of course, there's a long history to that.
So one of the places this goes that I am often uncomfortable with is the theories right now, they concentrate around George Soros.
Right.
Very wealthy financier, made a bazillion dollars shorting the British sterling, was it, right?
Yes,
before
yes.
The pound. But has done remarkable work promoting democracy across Eastern Europe, has done a huge amount of philanthropy over the years, and has also become the center of a huge amount of right-wing conspiracy theorizing. And something that people often say is that these theories about George Soros are anti-Semitic.
Mm-hmm.
And I go back and forth on this because obviously they fit into a long lineage of that kind of anti-Semitic theorizing. On the other hand, there's a lot of theorizing about the Koch brothers.
Right.
Which I think sometimes is overblown, but I don't think it's, say, anti-Christian. And
or people make this point about Adelson. I've heard
how Adelson,
this,
yes.
You know, say, well, why isn't the, you know, people talk about Adelson as a hidden hand too. Why isn't that anti-Semitic?
So that's my question for you, because you were just bringing up the economic globalist kind of thing. You know, people say nationalist is possibly an anti-Semitic idea, globalist. And There's a way in which when you're talking about anti-Semitism, it can get a little like boxing with phantoms.
Yes.
Because things that are one way when the light catches it, you know, through an open window.
Right.
And then a whole other way
right.
in another context. And then it becomes really hard. You feel like you're crying wolf and you know there's something there, but you're not sure what it is. And often you're not sure it is always there. I think that Donald Trump may very often use words that are often used by anti-Semites
right.
in just a more normal, crude way,
right.
But not mean them to be anti-Semitic, but somehow be emboldening them. That feels
yes.
like it feels like a very complicated space in this conversation to me, and one that is constantly being poorly handled.
It is really complicated. First of all, I think with Trump, the best explanation for things is usually starts with ignorance, right? So it's quite possible that Donald Trump, just like he didn't know the other day that the leaders of Lithuania and Latvia and Estonia were not responsible for the Balkan Wars, doesn't actually know very much about the history of anti-Semitism. And so that's part of the reason that he's not being careful. I agree. Look, I'm generally of the view that in the United States, certainly, people are innocent of anti-Semitism until proven guilty, right? And I'm generally willing to excuse one slip of the tongue, which seems to me a little bit problematic or disturbing, given my own radar, which may be more sensitive to others. I think it's kind of when you have a series of different instances, or when people have clearly kind of pushed back and said, listen, try to avoid this. Here's the story. And you're just basically willfully ignorant. And so I wouldn't call Trump an anti-Semite either, because who knows what the heck is going on in his mind and his heart. What I would say is that, you know, going back to that weird thing in 2013 with Jon Stewart, where he's basically like, why don't you give us your real name, Leibowitz? I mean, there's a weird way in which he's poked at this in a way that's really unusual for American politicians. Like, I wouldn't say that about Mike Pence or Ted Cruz or most of the other Republicans I really disagree. It's hard to know what the heck is going on
there. Do you remember the thing that happened right after he was inaugurated? They had a proclamation about the Holocaust.
Right.
And there was this outcry because they didn't specifically mention Jews in it.
Right.
And they sort of like they like all lives mattered
yes.
Jews in the
yes.
Holocaust.
Right.
Right. They're like, no, well, you know, people who weren't Jewish died in the Holocaust too. And it's
right.
true. Like
yes.
I remember when I was in Hebrew school, there was a particular day of remembrance when we would put on a little gold star and write 6 million in it. Mm-hmm. And I wrote 11 million because I get, you know,
oh,
and
precocious.
I was a very precocious
and
kid.
Universalistic.
Yeah. And but I, you know, but it was a very unusual thing for a White House to do, to not have a special notation about the fact that that was an eruption of anti-Jewish genocide,
right.
in addition to being a lot of other kinds of violence too. So like the point that there's something in this administration that, again, it never quite verges into outright anti-Semitism, but I can definitely see how if I were an anti-Semite looking for signals
yes.
that they were on my side, I'd be finding them.
Yeah. And I think another thing you see in the Trump administration that we've seen for a while on the American right is that they believe that there are good Jews and bad Jews. And this is part of, I think, the way they refute charges of anti-Semitism, but also convince themselves that there's no anti-Semitism, which is to say, if Jews are nationalistic, Zionistic, religious, embodying the values that they really like, then they're super supportive of those Jews, be Benjamin Netanyahu or people who support his politics. And it's when Jews tend to embody certain things that they don't like about the United States, when Jews tend to be secular, when Jews tend to ally with other groups that they feel like are threatening American identity, when Jews seem in some way to represent a kind of rootlessness or, as Trump would say, globalism that they feel like is a larger problem, those are the Jews they tend to go after. And Soros has become this kind of figure for them like that.
That's a super interesting point, because I've been wanting to bring in as the other piece of this what's happened in Israeli politics over roughly the last decade and how that's affected the conversation about Jews in American politics, which is, I remember growing up and then later on sort of being a political commentator sort of earlier in my career, and there feeling like there was a real live battle for Israel's kind of political soul. You know, where is it going to go towards peace orientations and a small d democratic view and a view of national identity that was not purely religious, where you could have sort of equality between people who also weren't Jewish? Or was it going to go into a defensive, crouched, and ultimately was going to have to become extremely illiberal posture to survive? And it feels like it has decisively taken the second path. You know, I sort of feel like my moment of exiting the conversation was when Avigdor Lieberman became foreign secretary. And I just sort of figured, well, okay, like that's what Israel is now. And that's not something that I feel I can be on board with. But what's happened since then, which I think has been interesting, has been there's been a real – and I think this happened under Obama – a real left Republican-Democratic polarization around Israel that didn't really exist in the same way before. Not to say Israel doesn't have baseline support among Democrats in politics, but in terms of support for the Israeli government as it stands in its current political configuration, it's become – Netanyahu has allied himself with the Republican Party in a way that is – I had not seen happen before. And that feels to me like it's helped create the sort of good Jew, bad Jew dichotomy where there's like a kind of Republican, nationalistic, you know, defensive, immigrant skeptic Jew. And then there's, you know, as you say, the sort of the rootless cosmopolitan Jew. And that feels like it's been really poisonous for the conversation.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. First of all, I think it's partly Netanyahu's Americanism. I mean, Israel had right-wing prime ministers like Yitzhak Shamir before, but Netanyahu, he's like the Republican senator from New York. He's such an American figure that I think it's very easy for American Republicans to love him. I mean, I think literally during the Obama administration, I heard them say, if only he were our president, you know? Like, they would say, he's the leader of the West that we don't have during the Obama years, which I thought was a very freighted phrase. But right, then for Americans who don't like him, he's like he was the Dick Cheney. You know, he's the equivalent of Dick Cheney, or now he's the equivalent of Donald Trump. So because he's so American, I think Americans have very strong opinions about him. But also, yeah, Israel has moved in the very direction that conservatives want America to move in. It's highly sovereignty oriented. It's extremely hostile to international law. It's becoming more religious, unlike the United States, which demographically is becoming less religious. Israel in the younger generation is more religious than the, which is the inverse of the United States. And it's at war essentially with the Muslim world. So it's kind of like the tip of the American spear in the clash of civilizations that Steve Bannon and these guys. So I think when they say that they are Zionists, I mean, not only them, by the way, Richard Spencer also interestingly now calls himself a Zionist. In one of the things that, which is really mind-bending, and but is that you see what white nationalists increasingly often say, Ann Coulter says this all the time. You can't listen to like seven sentences of Ann Coulter where they're saying this, but people further than her say this too, Richard Spencer, David, they all say, you know what they say? We want an immigration policy like Israel's, right? Because Israel has an immigration policy designed to maintain its demographic and ethnic identity. Why can't we have that in the United States? So there's a lot of identification from the mainstream right all the way to the anti-Semitic right with Israel. And one of the things that drives me crazy in the mainstream conversation is that whenever someone is accused of trafficking anti-Semitism on the right, they say, I just bought $1 million in Israel bonds. Don't you realize I want to go, you know, I love Israel more than anything. I'm plastering my house with Israeli flags. What the media generally doesn't understand is that it's perfectly possible and has always been possible to be extremely pro-Zionist and anti-Semitic. But think about it. If you have Jews that you don't want to live in your country, the idea of them having their own country is an extremely interesting idea. So the Polish government in the 1930s, for instance, right, which was a very anti-Semitic government, was so pro-Zionist, they actually sent Polish army officers to fight along with Beitar, along with Zionist militias, with the Irgun, because they were desperate for Jews to get their own state because that would solve the Polish-Jewish question, right? So you see this connection from the American right with Israel. And you're on the left, I think there's a growing sense of some consciousness among some groups of people of color, activists, of seeing Israel in some ways as aligned with exactly the forces that in the United States they don't like. So one of the things that Black Lives Matter has been really activated around is the close connection between Israeli and American police force, for instance, in terms of crowd control. And so you're seeing both sides essentially come to see Israel as a representation of either what they want America to be or what they don't want America to be.
It's funny that when you say all that, one of the things that's making me think about is how many arguments I had, you know, in the aughts, that you could be very pro-Jewish without necessarily being a right-wing Zionist, right? That there was a brand of Zionism that people often wanted to force you to buy into or else you were an anti-Semite or you were a self-hating Jew. And I was always arguing, no, that there are a lot more options on the table than that. You know, read Haaretz was always the line from that period. But what you're saying and what feels really true to me is that you can be a right-wing Zionist without being all that pro-Jewish. You don't have to be an anti-Semite, right? I take your point that you can be that too.
Yes.
But I had not put words to this before, but that there are a lot of folks in American right of center politics who feel to me like they're very pro-Netanyahu Zionism without actually being very pro-Jewish at all, seem to in fact be skeptical of a lot of, say, American Jews.
Right. And also remember, it's deeply ingrained within the Zionist ethos itself to look down on diaspora Jews, right? The whole logic of Zionism itself is that Jews, not just the Jews can't be safe in the diaspora, but that they can't self-actualize in the diaspora. They can never be fully human. They can never reach their full potential in diaspora. So in certain kind of way, the more you embrace the Zionist ethos, the more you're likely to take a dim view of American Jewish life, especially in a society which is in which, you know, which is assimilating at a very fast rate, right? In which you can easily see the Jewish content of American Jewish life is getting thinner and thinner. So it's not in a certain kind of way just anti-Semites who might be pro-Israel, but in a certain kind of way, there's a way in which the Zionist ethos itself is very dismissive of diaspora Jewish life. Some of the very things that we, the diaspora Jews, tend to love about themselves, their embrace of multiculturalism, in some ways, from a Zionist ethos, is part of the problem.
Support for The Gray Area comes from Mint Mobile. When you hear secret sauce, maybe you think of the mysterious ingredient in your favorite burger. Or perhaps it's your grandmother's terrifying meatloaf, which somehow seemed to secrete sauce. But from now on, when you hear secret sauce, I want you to think about Mint Mobile. Their secret is that they only sell wireless service online. That means they can cut the cost of retail stores and pass those savings directly to you. By switching to Mint Mobile, you can get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. To get this new customer offer and your new 3 month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, you can go to mintmobile.com/gray area. That's mintmobile.com/gray area. You can cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/gray area. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3 month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details. Support for this podcast comes from Greenlight. If your parents wrote you a blank check when you were 10 years old, what's the one thing you would have bought? I know for me, it would have been Podcast Futures. Or maybe that yellow Ford Ranger pickup truck that the lifeguards on Baywatch used to drive on the beach. That looked like a lot of fun. I don't know why I needed it. Didn't have the money anyway. But I wanted one. Would that have been a smart, long-term financial decision? Probably not. I would have learned that lesson the hard way. But what the Greenlight card wants to do is help your kids learn those vital financial lessons the easy way. Greenlight is a debit card and money app made for families. You can send your kids instant money transfers, get real-time notifications of spending, manage chores, and automate allowance. A colleague of mine here at Vox uses the Greenlight card with his two boys, and he loves it. You can sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free when you go to greenlight.com/gray area. That's greenlight.com/gray area to try Greenlight for free. greenlight.com/gray area.
One of the places I want to take this conversation, which is a little bit of a trickier place to take it, is just the experience of this right now. My experience of it, which has been surprising to me to feel, because I had, you know, the old line that anti-Semitism is a light sleeper. I'd grown up in a time when it just didn't feel like that to me. It felt like that was an aftershock of another age. And, you know, now it feels a little bit more like that to me. But I have had the experience, and I'm not saying it's a valid experience. I'm just saying it is mine. I'm not saying it's true or kind of objectively correct about the situation. But Israel as a kind of conceptual safe space feels a lot more unwelcoming. It feels like it as a place has gone in a direction that as somebody who believes in kind of liberal human values, I can't support. And America seems to have a real emboldening of a kind of conspiratorial anti-Semitism that I thought had weakened more than it had weakened, was further gone than I had expected. I mean, I think a lot of us who are journalists right now, who are on Twitter, who are engaged in online commentary, the flood of anti-Semitic vitriol that has accompanied the rise of Donald Trump, and again, this I'm really not blaming him for, but I am blaming some subset of his base for, has been shocking, like genuinely shocking. I just didn't see that one coming.
Nor did I.
And you know, and then you see it translating into real violence, real vandalism. What's going on in Europe is unnerving. And like, yeah, like there's a way in which it feels like there's an awakening anti-Semitism again, or an emboldening anti-Semitism, at the same time that Israel, which had a much broader representation of different kinds of jewelry seems like it is closed down into a particular version of itself, which as a country, that's its choice. I don't like it, but, you know, like I do believe in sovereignty to some degree. But I found it to be a very vulnerable feeling position.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, since I live on the Upper West Side of New York, I probably feel it less than a lot of other people do. But I think what the political consequences of this increased sense of vulnerability are will be really interesting because it can go politically in a couple of different directions, right? And we're seeing, you know, on the one hand, there is the argument that says, and this is what people on the right have been saying for a while, is that the safest bet for American Jews is to align with white Christians. First of all, white Christians have the power, so it's not a bad thing to align with people who actually have the power. Secondly, and I think you see this in Netanyahu, always seen this, that there's the genuine belief that we are on their side in this huge culture war. After all, they talk about Judeo-Christian America, after all. And there is, in weirdly, even despite the rising anti-Semitism, a tremendous amount of philo-Semitism in the Christian right, in the sense that Jews are a way of getting in touch with the quote-unquote Old Testament, right? And also, again, that Jews represent the West. Jews are the outpost of the West in this sea of our enemies. And so I think there's one argument that says, you know, and in a way, it's not exactly the same, but, you know, I am the child of South Africans, and there are echoes for me about the way I remember these debates within our own family. People would say, no, stick with the Afrikaners. They support Israel, first of all. They were very supportive of Israel. They traded arms with Israel. But also, they want Jews because they see Jews as white. That's an amazing accomplishment. They see us as white. Don't squander that, right? And then there's the second group, which is much where I think my heart is, and I imagine your heart is. It says, no, that actually our tradition itself, right, which 36 times in the Torah says, remember the heart of the stranger because you were strangers in the land of Egypt or some version of that, says that we must see ourselves aligned with a stranger. But also, they are our better allies. They are more reliable allies because they also feel this marginality. And also, if they succeed and they open up American identity, this is what Jews bet on during the Civil Rights Movement, right? Just at the time when social anti-Semitism was, it still existed. There were still quotas at Ivy League schools in the early 60s, some Ivy League schools. Jews said, if African Americans win, we will ride their coattails and all the barriers will end for us, right? The other group says, no, if African Americans win, if Latinos win, we will win too, and they will actually prove to be our best allies because they understand. And I have to say, the most moving and touching thing for me in the Trump era of almost anything else has been the way Muslims have rallied around Jews. I mean, we saw it publicly with this incredible outpouring of donations after Tree of Life. But in my own reporting, when I used to report about anti-Muslim stuff and I would call people Muslim activists or whatever, and if they knew I was Jewish, they would say to me often, listen, Peter, I know this is not what you're writing about. I'm just saying, you, we have to stick together. And that, I think there's a visceral understanding a lot of people in the American Muslim community. And the question is really whether we're going to reciprocate that. Because although I think most American Jews would, the American Jewish leadership is highly ambivalent about this question because it has a strong wing that's rooted in the Trump's Republican Party.
One of the things I think has been interesting is that for all that Donald Trump has really tried to have, again, a very pro-Netanyahu government is maybe the way I'm going to put this,
right,
foreign policy, it is not, as far as we can tell from the recent midterm elections, led to any kind of gain among political support in American Jewry.
Right.
There's a real visceral rejection of Donald
right.
Trump.
Right, because outside of the Orthodox community, which is about, they say, 10% of American Jews, the other 90% of American Jews don't really vote on Israel. They vote on American domestic issues, and they essentially, the most highly salient political fact, although it's a little embarrassing for everyone to, I think, acknowledge, to understand American Jewish political behavior, the most important thing to understand is how secular Jews are. It's not essentially their Jewishness, it's their secularism. They vote like highly secular people on issues, you know, abortion, gay rights, these issues that track with education and with secularism. And that roots them in the Democratic Party and puts them totally at odds with Trump.
So I want to go back to something we were talking about a little bit ago, because I do think it figures in here on the nature of anti-Semitism as a kind of conspiracy theory that interlocks with other political opinions.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that you have different kinds of bigotry that operate mm-hmm. simultaneously. Some kinds of bigotry are saying that a group of people is less than, mm-hmm. they're less intelligent than you, they're less human than you, they're less civilized than you, they're
right.
less moral than you. And then the other is this kind of, as you put it, like sinister mastermind
mm-hmm. right.
form of bigotry.
Right.
And it's only been reading some of the commentary after Tree of Life that I've understood how long a lineage there is
yes.
of connecting different kinds of equality movements
mm.
where, you know, the idea is that on the one hand you have groups you believe, and this coming from the perspective of the bigots, like groups you believe are less than, mm-hmm. who are somehow organizing effectively. And so you have to add Jews into the mix as tacticians,
yes.
or else the whole picture can't make sense.
Yes.
It's a very Baroque view of the world.
Yes. I think it has – you know, I'm not an historian. This. My sense is that it partly has its roots in the class position that Jews held in medieval Europe. Jews were not the peasantry, but they were not the nobility either. What they were they were much more literate than others because their religious traditions tended – especially women tended to be much more literate than other women. They were also because of – they were allowed to earn interest on loans, which in medieval Europe Christians weren't supposed to do. And they were urbanized. And they also had these transnational networks, right? The Jews spoke a common language. They could basically create business networks and they could become money lenders, right, financiers and merchants. So they, in some ways, were much more privileged than most of the people in medieval Europe, but also
a market-dominant minority.
Yes, exactly.
Is like the technical term. Right?
Yes, exactly right. Like maybe the Chinese in Malaysia or something, right?
Yes.
But also vulnerable because they were politically not disempowered. They had money but not power. And it's funny, that Jeremy Suri, who's a historian at University of Texas, has this fascinating riff on Henry Kissinger and Kissinger's view of global politics where he argues that it's partly rooted in a deeply Jewish fear of populism. Because for Jews, the terrifying thing was always the peasant revolt. The peasants couldn't get to the nobles, but they could get to the Jews who the nobles sent out to collect money or who were doing these. And there were echoes of this a little bit in the 60s when Jews were in African-American neighborhoods as landlords or as, you know, owning stores. And so that intermediate position has on the one hand made Jews seem higher up, but on the other hand been a source of vulnerability.
So that's operating in the kind of anti-Semitic psyche. And at the same time, it feels to me that one of the big contributors to this period has been just digital media generally. You now have everybody with like the little parentheses around their thing right. that is meant to show solidarity but emerges out of anti-Semites online, like putting those parentheses right. around the names of people in the media who are Jewish. And I wonder how much the feelings and concerns, at least if you take Tree of Life out of the equation, which I know is a strange thing to do given when we're talking, but aside from that unbelievable outbreak of violence, is this just one of these things where the internet exposes things that were already there and then the media kind of amplifies it and reports on it and makes it feel like a more present threat than it really is? Like, do you take what we see online as example that anything has changed, or just that digitally there's now this capacity to like see it in your comment threads or your Twitter mentions, and it's a very low cost for the anti-Semites to reach you? And so we're not really seeing anything new. We're just seeing the sort of online visibility of things that are always there.
Yeah. I mean, clearly there were neo-Nazis. There were acts of violence before the internet. People are able to create communities in the way they weren't before, clearly. And as you mentioned earlier, I do think that Donald Trump perhaps has given people a sense of comfort or being emboldened in a way that has strengthened them. And I also just think – and again, it's more my gut than anything I could prove. I just think it's difficult to disentangle. If you're in a climate where bigotry is being legitimized in general, I just think it's difficult to segment off. I mean, it's like most of these people are anti-Semites. It's not like they have a great opinion of, you know, feminists, you know, LGBT folks, African Americans, right?
That huge world of feminist anti-Semites.
Right, exactly. I mean, it's kind of a package deal, right? And so in some ways, like, I think, again, it's like you buy the package and Jews are part of the package, you know?
I want to be careful about this because I'm not sure this is true. And maybe it's about what I see. Mm-hmm. I actually think that the political power that is being wielded against other minorities in this country, specifically Hispanic immigrants and African Americans, is much more dangerous. But there does seem to be something about online anti-Semitism that is particularly intense. Again, like maybe it's just what I see, right? Yeah. I am Jewish and I'm not African American. So, you know, I only have my vantage point on this. But the ways in which particularly anti-Semitism seems to be a popular form of like young male transgressive action on the internet does seem a little specific.
You know, part of this notion that is so strong on the right these days is that we have this politically correct culture where you have to tiptoe around all these other groups, right? Sometimes you hear Jews saying this too, you know, conservative Jews vis-a-vis African-Americans or, you know, women or whatever. But in a certain kind of way, I think part of what may be happening is that the truth is that Jews have been because the Jewish community is very well organized and very politically kind of articulate, have been extremely effective, I would say, in having an influence in the public discourse. I mean, just think about the use of the word Holocaust, right? Or the use of the word anti-Semitism. We have essentially been able to have certain words that reflect particularly about the attacks on us, make them into very powerful, loaded terms, right? And I think in a certain way, for those people who buy into this, I think, nonsensical idea that the big problem in America is that people are too sensitive, right? And that in a way, maybe they see Jews as the group that has been most effective in preventing anybody from hurting their feelings, right? And so there does seem to be this weird way that the contemporary anti-Semitism today loves to play with that, right? All these Holocaust jokes kind of, right? All these is kind of like, you're not going to tell me that I can't tread on this kind of thing. Besides, maybe I'm just joking, ha, 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 you know? And it's this like transgressive thing against, if there is a politically correct culture, meaning too much sensitivity, which don't necessarily buy, Jews are definitely part of that in the sense that like Jews are probably quicker than anyone else as an organized group, just because I think we're more politically articulate, better organized to respond very quickly to a sense that we are being attacked. And I think maybe that's part of what's playing into this.
It's something I'm always fascinated by in the conversation about political correctness, because there are plenty of Jews who are on the other side of that conversation from me. Plenty of Jews who feel like the PC police have gone way too far.
Right.
And the thing I always think when I see that is that the thing that a lot of people who have been bound by social political correctness want to say is not that I can misgender trans people, but that Jews are bad. I always think the political, like the reality of the political correctness debate in America is just much cruder than these sort of like campus fights make it seem like. And it's like we in the media have a lot of debates and they're like angry and they're intense about like the new frontiers in political correctness, right? The groups that are just now getting enough power to make their claims. But when Donald Trump like ran for president, what he said was immigrants are bad. He said that Hispanic immigrants are rapists and criminals, and maybe a couple of them are good people too. He was not coming out to say, God, I just do not like safe spaces. Or I think trigger warnings on certain pieces of canon literature are problematic. And the thing that is being bound in political correctness is it's usually, and I think it's dominantly, much more widespread in ancient forms of hatred, and very much including against Jews. And Jews have very effective organizations, the Anti-Defamation League, et cetera, that basically enforce certain kinds of speech boundaries. And we do not – as always, whenever a group is effective at this battle, it stops becoming identity politics. It stops becoming political correctness. Now it's just like being a decent person. But it's the same kind of thing. And the desire to establish a bunch of principles that go harshly in the other direction never seems to me to be a long-term wise strategy.
The thing that drives me crazy often with kind of, you know, conservative Jews is that I feel like they tend to bend over backwards to give Republicans the benefit of the doubt when it comes to racism, sexism, et cetera. And yet they're, you know, to use it, they're so machmir, like they're so hardline on anti-Semitism, right? Anything which seems to me often just like a severe criticism of Israel for them can become anti-Semitism. And yet I'm saying like, if you're going to be that hardline on the anti-Semitism stuff, fine. But then have the same standard for the racism and sexism stuff. Don't basically, don't, you know, be consistent.
So let me use this as a bridge to talk a little bit about Israel. As somebody who is less versed in Israeli politics than you are, and you and I used to have debates about this sometimes. I used to occasionally write in Haaretz. I was more involved in this discussion at a certain point in my career, but I've not been as much. And one of the reasons I've not been is just the feeling that the set of political possibilities in Israel has collapsed. And in particular, the sort of peace movement in Israel feels like it has collapsed. And I'm curious sort of what your gloss on why that is.
Yeah. And I actually want to ask you about that too when we get a second because I feel like
we got all the time.
your decision not to write about this, I think, is actually significant. And, you know, without buttering you up, it's actually – and I think indicative of something. And honestly, to be honest, I often sometimes ask myself or my wife will ask me, like, why the heck am I writing about it so much? Like, because as you say, there's a very strong feeling of beating your head up against the wall. First of all, because you're right, the legacy of the Second Intifada moved Israel to the right. There was a very, very strong narrative after the end of the Second Intifada in 2004 and then the Gaza withdrawal in 2005 that Israel had withdrawn from Gaza, it had given the Palestinians everything they could have wanted in the Camp David negotiations, and it had been met with terrorism, right? I always try to tell people that it's important to distinguish the power of a subjective narrative from the historical accuracy that a lot of people thought America lost Vietnam because we were stabbed in the back by the anti-war movement. And that helped elect Ronald Reagan. Didn't make it true, right? I think actually empirically, both of those arguments don't have a lot to recommend them if you look carefully at what happened. But that has helped move Israel to the right, plus the demographic shift, right? Growing population of ultra and modern Orthodox Jews, a Russian population that's further to the right. And so, yes, all of those things are true. And also, you know, the Israel debate in the United States is nasty. It's intimate, which is part of what I like about it. Like, I like the fact that people care so much. Like, even the guy who, like, accosted me on the way to shul, like, last year while I was with my kids and his kids, and he said, "Are you Peter Beinart?" I said, "Yeah," like an idiot. I said, "Yeah, I am Peter Beinart." And he says, "I think your politics are full of shit." You know, like, there's a perverse part of me that likes—
Shabbat shalom.
I know, Shabbat. I was like, it's Shabbos, you know, like, but there's a part of me, first part of me that likes the fact that people care so much. Like, if I write about a lot of the things, I feel like, people are just like, you know, but in a way, it's an ugly little sandbox, you know, and it's like, I think, in a parochial little sandbox. So it's very difficult to tell a story in which change comes from within. If I had to tell a story in which there's change, the story I would tell would be the change will come from the Palestinians because they're the ones who have the incentive to change things. Right? They're the ones who are being oppressed, right? People who are, you know, Frederick Douglass said, power can seize nothing without a demand, right? The Palestinians will continue to find ways of making life uncomfortable for Israelis, whether it's violent intifadas, nonviolent uprisings, various things. Right now, the cost of occupation is low for Israel. So there's no political need. In recent Israeli elections, they haven't even really focused on this issue that much. Eventually, because Israel has this setup where there's a kind of indirect rule in the West Bank. The Palestinian Authority basically runs things on Israel's behalf, mostly funded by the Europeans. Israel doesn't have to send its 18-year-olds to patrol every Palestinian village. If it sees some guys it doesn't like, it calls up the PA, who sends their guys in there. And the PA picks up the garbage, they run the schools, they do all that stuff. Eventually, I believe the PA will collapse. It has no legitimacy among Palestinians. Palestinians didn't sign up to create their own subcontracted occupation. They thought this was going to become a state. When that collapses, Israel faces a much tougher choice. Do we directly control the West Bank, which is, send our 18-year-olds to walk through the narrow pathways in Hebron and Qalqilia? The reason the Oslo was created was because the first intifada showed Israelis that the cost was high. What I hope is that when that moment happens, there has to be a new conversation in Israel because the cost of occupation goes way up, which may embolden the far right too. They might say, you know, we have a great answer. Put them on buses and send them to Jordan, but also creates an opportunity for the left that American politics will be in a different place. And Bernie Sanders is doing a lot of interesting things in that regard.
So your view is that what happened is, because before we go into how it could change, I want to pin down the story of what happened, is that basically, there are two things. One was that the pullout of Gaza, the legacy of the Intifada, and the fact that it just was able to recede as an issue because a security and distancing and subcontracting strategy basically removed its salience, allowed for the whole thing to just recede. I guess this is a question I've had. It feels to me like there was a very sharp point at which things changed. It was like Ehud Barak loses to Ariel Sharon. It felt to me like there was a centrist coalition with Ehud Olmert, and they sort of lose out to Netanyahu. And after that, there was like no Israeli left in Israeli politics of any real note. And it went from being a very vital part of the political situation to very weakened very quickly.
Yeah.
And that doesn't seem to me to track onto the timing of after effects of the Intifada. Maybe it tracks onto the timing of getting out of Gaza and it just reducing in salience.
Yeah.
But I've never quite understood the nature of that collapse.
Yeah. So I would say you have the Camp David negotiations in the summer of 2000. Then in the fall of 2000, you have this second Intifada. The second Intifada, which is much more violent, much more violence against civilians, suicide bombing, et cetera, than the first Intifada, and lasts 4 years, definitely damages the Israeli left dramatically. Also because Ehud Barak endorses the narrative. Ehud Barak himself, partly to save himself politically, says, no, I was a super dove. I gave them everything. And look, Arafat responded with this violence. So that hurts the left dramatically in Israel. Plus, you have a long-term demographic trend, which is that the Labor Party and Meretz, which is to its left, are relying on secular Ashkenazi Israelis who are a diminishing part of the population. And the other part, and this part is not almost never, I think, discussed enough in the American media. The nature of the Israeli political system is that to create a Knesset majority of 61 seats, by tradition, you have to have 61 Jewish seats. It is not considered legitimate to bring in the Arab Israelis, the Palestinian citizens of Israel, and their political parties to get to the majority. And that always means that the right is in power. It's almost the equivalent of not being able to rely on African-American votes for the Democratic Party in the United States. So what you find—
And there's nothing in the rules about that.
Nothing in the rules, but the notion is this is a Jewish state. If we're going to make big decisions for the state, there has to be a Jewish majority in the Knesset. And so even when you had Ehud Barak there or Yitzhak Rabin, in order to fish around for his Knesset majority, he had to go to more right-wing or religious parties that didn't really share his values. And I think part of the conversation that we're still not really having in the United States, which is a challenging conversation to have, which has to then do with the nation of Jewish statehood, has to do with looking under the hood a little bit and understanding better the ways in which the tensions between liberal democracy and real equality and Jewish statehood as it exists in Israel today condition a whole series of things. But you also notice that people in the American press frequently use the term Israelis as synonym for Jewish Israelis.
Yep.
Right? Like all Israelis from left to right oppose the Iran deal. Really? 20% of the population, right? That's larger than either African Americans or Hispanics, liked Barack Obama, supported the Iran deal, wildly for a Palestinian state, right? And that's often erased in our conversation.
That's super. That's an interesting and fair point and reflects my language as well. One of the things that struck me at that period is that the right-wing coalition got a lot more right too.
Yeah.
And I think that was actually the thing for me. And I'm happy to talk about sort of like my evolution on this stuff. But for me, the real break came around, not Netanyahu, who's a figure in Jewish politics I always like saw and understood.
Yeah.
And like he's like, you know, part of the firmament and has been for a long time. But it was the rise of Avigdor Lieberman,
right,
who was so deeply illiberal,
yes,
and so violent to what I understood as the political character of Israel, right? This idea that Israel was this really beautiful and very unusual mixture, a haven for a Jewish people, and also a place that believed deeply in liberal values. And when Avigdor Lieberman was made foreign secretary and when he rose up, that was when it just seemed to me that Israel had gone somewhere I had not expected it to go. And I guess like the reason I stopped writing about it, to be honest, and it, I mean, one reason is that like foreign policy isn't my main issue.
Right.
You know, there's like only so many things. But the reason I wrote about Israel was that I had a real and have to some degree kind of emotional connection to it.
Yeah.
You know, like I've been to Israel a number of times.
Yeah.
My family has been, you know, my grandparents took me when I was young. And I mean, I was there and I think the last time was probably 07. And something about that turn began to snap the connection. And it was the mixture of that political turn with some of the kind of like calling me a self-hating Jew for writing. It didn't really change how I felt, but it changed my view that I had really sort of that it made sense for me to be prioritizing this over other issues that were, I think, also extremely important in the world. And so just some of my attention just went elsewhere because it felt like, you know, Israel is a nation. It had chosen a political path that I thought was very, very self-destructive, but it was its choice to make. But it kind of like broke the idea for me that it was partially mine too, right? Which I think I, like a lot of young Jews, had that like Israel, even though I'm not there, I don't, you know, plan to live there, it's partially mine too.
Yes.
And that somehow, in some way I can't quite explain, was related not just to its Jewish character, but to its liberal character, right? Not like liberal in the kind of left-right American way, but liberal in the overall liberal values way.
Right.
And as that weakened, that emotional connection for me weakened too.
Yeah, yeah.
And at some point it seemed that I was writing about something that I just didn't quite understand why I was writing about it anymore. Like as opposed to a dozen other conflicts that were causing more loss of life and more suffering elsewhere in the world.
Right. Well, see, this is in some ways the structural disadvantage of the Jewish left in the United States, which is that it's composed of people like you who are morally universalistic. So you care about a whole range of things, even if they don't affect.
This is a totally reasonable point.
Right. And in a way, this is why even if there are as many Jews who sympathize with J Street with AIPAC, AIPAC is stronger because the Jews who support J Street are also spending part of their money on climate change and immigrants' rights. The AIPAC people are tribal. Right? So they're very single issue focused, right? And they stay in that game because they're focused, they're concerned about what they think is good for Jews, right? This is in some ways what, when I go to speak on college campuses about this, if I speak to college students, the harder sell is not to convince them that what the Netanyahu government is doing is bad. The harder thing is to convince them, and it's very hard, is why they should pay any attention to this given that climate change is going on, right? And for me personally, I can only say it's because I'm not actually that pure universalist. Like, I have a very strong tribal streak that was infused in me. And, like, for me, the fate of the Jewish people is of paramount importance. Partly, I think I stay involved because I feel very much inspired and connected to people on the Israeli left who I really admire. I was at a Shabbat lunch a year ago with a really brilliant Israeli academic, and she had a job at Princeton, and she was going back to teach at Tel Aviv University. And I said, why are you going back? I said, do you have any hope of changing things? And she said, no, I'm like an abolitionist in the 1820s. And she said, but this is my country, and I'm going to be there for it. And I thought, you know, when I go with people in Breaking the Silence, you know, I feel like if they are willing to do this, then I feel like they're in Mississippi, the equivalent of Mississippi. I'm the guy sitting on the Upper West Side. The least I can do is to support them if they're doing it. But the other thing for me, and again, I think just personally, it's probably being the child of South Africans, is for me, what's on trial in Israel is Judaism in a certain sense, which is to say, Judaism, I find, has had a magnificent set of ethical interventions and arguments and ideas over the centuries. They've had a big impact in the world. But the tricky thing was that the entire Jewish ethical tradition is forged in powerlessness. It's never tested by power. So for me, and there is this great kind of interaction in Yehuda Halevi's book Kuzari, where he's talking to the pagan king and he's saying, we Jews have an ethical tradition that's better than Christianity. You know, in Jewish tradition, Christianity is called Edom, red, blood, associated with the figure of Esau, violent. And the pagan king says, what are you talking about? You just haven't had the opportunity yet, you know? And for me, in a way, if it turns out that Israel is the great test of Jewish power because it's Jewish sovereignty, and if Israel fails that test, for me, in a certain kind of sense, so much of what I was raised to believe and I want to believe about the Jewish tradition becomes kind of bullshit. And so for me, that's why it matters, even though I have no expectation that I'll move to Israel either. But, you know, it's very hard to say that things are not looking good.
In U.S. working forests, or forest land carefully managed to provide a steady, renewable supply of wood for daily use, more than 1 billion trees are planted every year, and forestry experts protect and manage hundreds of millions of acres. Working forests have been sustainably managed for decades. How? It's simple. They plant more trees than they harvest. Learn more at workingforestsinitiative.com.
Support for this show comes from Sylvan Learning. As a parent, you want your child to have every opportunity. But giving them the tools they need to tackle every challenge, that takes a team. Now more than ever, educational support tailored exactly to what your child needs can make all the difference. That's why parents have trusted Sylvan Learning for 45 years as the ultimate teammate in their child's educational journey, instilling in them a love for learning and a passion for reaching the next level. And Sylvan's Insight Assessment can identify gaps in learning and areas that could be of concern for your child. It's a 360-degree view into your child's learning that you can't find anywhere else, and helps ensure that your child didn't miss something in school that might put them at a disadvantage in the future. And right now, it's the best price of the year at $29. Go to sylvan29.com to learn more and get your child's assessment for only $29. That's sylvan29.com.
One of the things that I found very depressing about the direction that Judaism in Israel went, I don't want to say the direction that the political leadership in Israel went, was ultimately, it seemed like, a very dangerous one. Mm-hmm. You've probably read, I'm sure you have, Philip Roth's Operation Shylock. Mm-hmm. And, you know, where Philip Roth creates this kind of alternative Philip Roth, saying things that Philip Roth clearly believes but doesn't quite want to be tagged for. It's a very interesting and unusual book. But, you know, the argument made in there that what you're going to do is you're going to pack the maximum number of Jews into the smallest possible space, surround them with people who hate them, and then execute a long-term political strategy based around making those people hate them even more.
Yes. Yeah.
Seems like the idea that they are safeguarding the fate of the Jewish people in a wise way has struck me as not true for some time now. Like, just as a pure question of like long-term tactical thinking, or strategic thinking rather, Israel cannot possibly be safe in a world of weapons of mass destruction, with everyone around them hating them and with this population in their midst who is becoming endlessly radicalized.
Yes.
But it's like that's obviously not a decision that I can or have the right or have the traction to make for anybody there. But it did become this way in which one of the constant statements about like why you should be so concerned about Israel, which is like it is a safe home for the Jews.
Right.
Like I would look and think it feels to me like it's in like long term, like this is a very dangerous strategy.
Absolutely.
Very high risk.
Right. And you do have the right to make that argument. First of all, just like you have the right to criticize Bolsonaro in Brazil.
Sure.
Right.
And I do.
You have the right.
Yeah,
right.
Fair enough.
So, you know, the UN says that Gaza will be unlivable by 2020, partly because there will be no water. Right. And no drinkable water. Like that's just down the beach from Tel Aviv. You know, like that's insane. Like the idea that you can extract yourself from the conditions of the people in which you live. And as you say, 20% of Israel's own population inside the Green Line are Palestinians, right? They call them Arab Israelis, but they're Palestinians. And right now, the danger is not as apparent. But ultimately, as population shifts, the Palestinians also have another big advantage over Israeli Jews that I think is not commonly understood. I think the Palestinians understand it. I think the Jews don't really recognize it, which is to say, most Israeli Jews, and this is kind of ironic given Zionism, they actually do have somewhere else to go. Right? They're a first world population, which is generally quite connected to other first world populations. If things in Israel get bad, they can go to Canada or Australia, right? Even today, some of them do that, right? They go to Silicon Valley, right? The Palestinians don't really have anywhere to go just because of the nature of their economic circumstance. So in a certain kind of way, they can wait the Jews out. Let's imagine you get to a situation where you're basically in long-term civil war with constant violence and the economy going down. And the Palestinians, like, that's not going to be that much worse for them than things are now. But for Israeli Jews, it's going to be a dramatic, and they will start to immigrate. And that's ultimately, I think, how if Zionism loses and if the Jewish state loses, that's what will happen. It will be because of immigration, because Jews will ultimately – they won't stay, the mobile part of the population. And so this is why I think – and Palestinians have always been saying this point. They've always been saying, don't you get it? The two-state solution is more necessary for you than it is for us, right? But I think through – arrogance, you know, the Israeli political leadership, the American Jewish leadership have forgotten that. And they've bought into this idea that, again, because Mohammed bin Salman whispers in their ear and says, we don't really care about the Palestinians. They can make the Palestinians knuckle under and they can live high on the hog without the Palestinians causing them problems.
Yeah. So I think that is all very well taken. The other thing I want to pick up on in what you said is this idea that if Israel continues this hard turn towards the right, it will break for you some idea of what Jewishness is. And I was trying to think about how that landed with me because I realized that I didn't quite feel that way. But what I did feel was that I had always really rejected and really been offended by the conflation of how Jewish you were, how you felt about Judaism, how much you identified with it, what you had learned from it, and how you felt about the ongoing political strategy of Israel. Going back before some of like the current turn to the right, like that was always a rhetorical move that I was very angry about and continue to be to this day. But one thing that has definitely happened for me is because I don't, I think, make that link to the degree some people do, as Zionism has moved into a place that is more directly in conflict with what I understand Judaism to be, and particularly I think I understand Judaism very much as you do, and it's a religion of the dispossessed. It's a religion of recognizing that you too were once a stranger in Egypt. These are the parts of it I find very beautiful. The Jewish history that really moves me is like this history of a people who have suffered enormously and have made something of that suffering, who have found a beauty and a moral courage in that suffering. As Israel has come to represent that less for me, it has become more detached from my sense of Jewishness. And my sense, talking to other young Jews, like being on college campuses, things like that, is that this has happened, whether kind of consciously or less so, for a lot of people. Yes. And one thing that feels to me to be quite dangerous for Israel long term, and I think you're sort of like beginning to signal this when you mentioned Bernie Sanders, is that I am not sure that Israel, if it continues in the direction it goes, if you imagine a much more liberal political coalition taking power in America, it can rely on the same intuitive level of connection and support from liberal Jewry that it has in the past, that it had sort of my grandfather's generation, right, or even in my father's generation. And I'm uncomfortable with that, mm-hmm, right? Like I don't want – on some level, I don't want that to be true.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I do think that's there. I think that space is opening up in this conversation that wasn't there before because, you know, I think there are a lot of younger Jews in America who look at Israel and they don't see a Judaism they recognize. They see a place that is overwhelmingly Jewish and that has gone in a kind of scary political direction. And like, I don't know exactly what you say about that, but you know, you probably just downweight it in the set of things you're worried about in the world.
Yeah, I think that's right. And we haven't even mentioned, but this is a big part of it, of course, that you know, one of the things that happened after Pittsburgh was this controversy about the Ashkenazi chief rabbi refusing to call Tree of Life a synagogue, right?
Oh, my God.
Because Israel, the Israeli government, which has a corrupt official Orthodox rabbinate, doesn't recognize the legitimacy of the kind of Judaism that most American Jews practice. And so there was this line where Naftali Bennett says, you know, when the anti-Semites come to kill you, they don't ask if you're Orthodox, conservative, or reform, right? And when my immediate response was, yes, but the Israeli government does. Right? You know, so like, that's part of it, even as, you know, in addition to the Palestinians. And you're right. I do think that something really interesting is happening in the Democratic Party. And part of it is that the American Jewish organizational establishment, represented above all by AIPAC, which is the most powerful American Jewish organization, still has an enormous amount of power. But it's not equally distributed between the two parties anymore.
Right.
It's much, much, much more powerful in the Republican Party. And in fact, someone who was running the Obama administration even speculated to me recently that the Democrats in 2020 might not even go and speak at AIPAC, a lot of them. And in a way, as things have become so partisan, Democrats can afford to ignore. They might still get pilloried by people on the American Jewish right, but those aren't their people. So they don't matter as much to them anymore. They can afford to afford it. And I think what Sanders is going to do, which is going to be really interesting, is his bet is that just as Donald Trump saw that there was a disconnect between Republican elites and Republican voters on trade and immigration, and he could leverage that and then create a model for all the other Republicans, say, aha, this is where our people actually are. I think Sanders is going to do that on Israel. He's already saying that he supports conditioning military aid, which is way, way beyond anything Barack Obama ever said.
Do you just want to define what that is for people?
Yeah, so he's going to basically say, we're not going to give Israel military aid strings with no strings attached. We're going to say maybe you have to reduce settlement growth or something like this. And I think he may find that there is that it is a winning political issue in the Democratic primary. Maybe not in the general election. But first of all, think about how many Arab and Muslim and Palestinian Americans have never had anybody actually they could look to on this issue. And as you say, a lot of younger people, there's still deep anger, I think, among a lot of African Americans about the way Netanyahu treated Barack Obama. All of this is there. And I think it could mean that the Democratic Party moves. It's not going to be like the Labor Party in Britain. The political culture here is too different. But I do think that people are going to go beyond what Barack Obama did. And the other thing, which I think is part of it, is that the Democratic Party's moved to reliance more on small donors. Because if you rely more on small donors, you also defang. Again, this can start to sound like anti-Semitic, but the truth is that one of the ways that the American Jewish organizations wield influence, like every other, like the NRA or whatever, is by bundling a lot of donations. If you're not reliant on that, like Beto O'Rourke isn't, in some ways you see a real distinction, not only in the population, but even among members of Congress, the Democrats. The younger Democrats tend to be more open to criticizing Israel than the older ones.
I also just think, and this speaks to some of the things Sanders has been saying, there is just a flat reality that if you have a liberal orientation towards foreign policy,
right,
and your foreign policy is based on some level on a recognition of human rights and
right,
a belief and a rejection of oppression, that where things have gone in Israel is just – it's objectively more offensive. I mean, you write about this eloquently and
yeah,
constantly,
yeah,
but you know, Israel has become a quite brutal police state to the Palestinians. I mean, it is not a reasonable way to make people to live. It's like there are many moral atrocities happening all over
yes,
the world at all times,
yes,
right? It is not a unique one happening there, but it is a real one happening there. And, you know, at some points there's just a much more active peace movement, but there's also kind of been an Israel exception. But the worse it gets,
right,
just the harder it gets to like carve it out. And then the
yeah,
more sort of concentrated its support gets in one party, right? I continue to think that Netanyahu made an unbelievable series of, for Israel's future, strategic miscalculations in the way he treated Obama. That it was like, I understand the short-term political incentives of it,
right,
but it was such a bad idea. He
right,
alienated so many people he needed to have on his side in the long term in the Democratic Party. Like it honestly broke my heart a little bit. But I take those points about the political strategy of it and how it's lining up. But there is just like – there's just like also a reality of it that, you know, it just causes tension.
Right. And one of the really interesting things – so one of the most effective things that groups like AIPAC do is they take members of Congress, but not only members of Congress, all kinds of American influential people to Israel, which is a very powerful experience for a lot of them. And it's understandably, I mean, I love going to Israel, but they don't take them to see Palestinian life. And in my experience, and most American Jewish leaders also don't actually ever really, they may have been to Israel 77 times, but they've also not really ever experienced Palestinian life. So it's kind of like the equivalent of like, going to New York City, only spending your time on the Upper East Side, never going to the Bronx, and then basically coming and talking about what you learned about community relations with the police, right? It's not a great analogy, but the point is that they what they don't see is as important as what they do see. When people actually do go to spend time and see life of Palestinians up close, it is generally a transformative.
Yeah, which experience. I'm sure you've done. I've done a bit of also.
Yeah.
That's part of where my attitudes on this come from. Like
right.
You can't look at that and say it's okay. You just can't.
Exactly. All of the rationalizations. It's worse in Syria. They brought it on themselves. Like they have a certain surface plausibility when we're sitting here in New York. When you actually go and you meet decent, normal people who have lived there. I mean, let's just think about it in American terms. People in Mississippi in 1953 were at least theoretically citizens of the United States. They couldn't actually actualize that citizenship. They couldn't vote. But they were theoretically citizens. The Palestinians are not – they live under Israeli control. They're not even theoretically citizens of the country under which they live. They never have been, right? So they have – the entire state apparatus that dominates their lives is completely unresponsive to them and only responsive to the Jews who live alongside them. So they lose every day in every interaction they have. That is really brutal to see. And I think one of the things that I would really hope that people would start to do more is create more of an opportunity for more people to have that experience that you had.
The thing that gets said here where when you bring this up, people are like, well, it's worse in Syria.
Right.
Like it is. It
yes.
is worse in Syria. Like let me just say like what is happening in Syria is like it's beyond imagining. But you really can't have it both ways. You can't both have the – there should be a special relationship with Israel and particularly if you're Jewish that you should have a special connection to Israel and feel a stake in its success and its actions and its future and feel like – it represents you and you represent it on some level. And so you should treat it specially. Right. But as soon as you say it's doing wrong, then it has to be in a completely normal, objective, detached, ordinal ranking of countries and human rights abuses and whatever all around the world. Like either there is something unique about Israel and the relationship, in this case of American Jews, to it, which creates something uniquely offensive about Israel acting in this way towards a minority that it is subjugating. Or you can say there is worse things elsewhere in the world, but then like if the idea is that you treat Israel sort of very normally on that front, then well, why not on other fronts? Why does Israel get more foreign aid? Why does it get more military aid, right? Like you can't have the special relationship only happen in the positive spaces.
Right, exactly. Right. I mean most of these other countries that are doing these horrible things worse than Israel, the United States isn't paying for their militaries, you know, is not giving them huge amounts of military aid. We are really deeply implicated in those things. And I think a lot of this ends up being kind of whataboutism, you know. And the truth is that things don't have to be the worst, you know, human rights abuse in the world to be bad and to be something that one should be concerned about, especially for Jews. Like imagine if, you know, Jews were protesting Soviet oppression of Jews in the 1970s, right? I didn't hear a lot of people going and saying, this is double standards because what Pol Pot and Idi Amin are doing is worse, right? This mattered to Jews, right? And I feel like what happens in Israel should matter to Jews, partly because I think it's morally horrendous and partly, as you said, absolutely rightly, from a long-term perspective, it is an existential threat to the survival of the state of Israel. And it's amazing how many former Israeli, you know, military and security heads say that all the time, you know? They often sound more left-wing than J Street.
Yeah, there's always been that strange dimension to it where the common line 10 years ago was that the range of opinions that you're allowed to have in Israel is broader than the ones that you're allowed to have before getting called bad names in America.
Right.
It does seem to me to have collapsed a little bit within the Israeli political system, but certainly not all the way.
Yeah, yeah. But I think one of the things, you know, it's not for me to tell anyone else what to write about because there are so many different subjects that really matter and we all have our things to speak. But I think that one of the, I would say, the costs of extremely successful, extremely talented, not to flatter you, but, you know, people like yourself or, you know, or Matt Iglesias or others, of not writing about this.
I never thought I'd see the day when Peter Beinart was demanding that me and Matt get back into the Israel conversation.
Well, I know. Marty Peretz and me, you know, I never forgive you.
Yeah, no, Marty Peretz should not be pleased.
But I think there are a couple things. First of all, as you know, a great many non-Jews simply are too afraid to write about it, right? They're just not going to do that because they know that as much of a pain in the neck as it might be for you to be called self-hating Jew, they're going to be called anti-Semitic. So I'm always struck, I don't know if you are, by the level of virtual terror often that many non-Jews have about this issue, right? So you have a form of protection that they don't have. Secondly, when you show that you can do it and survive, yeah, people say some mean things to you, but you survive, you do fine. A lot of this is fear-based. I mean, a lot of this, I think what maintains the American political discussion about Israel is the fear that people have. And when people walk through it and come out the other side and survive, that starts to fizzle.
But do you think fear is a big part of it anymore? I mean, I remember, back when I did write about it more, and I again want to say, like, I never wrote about it that much. Mm. So me moving to just like mostly not writing about
it
was not like some huge change in my life. Like, I'm having this podcast on it because like I'm interested. But it just was like, you know, Donald Trump got elected president. Like things happened. But I never found it that scary. Like, I mean, people can call it, like, I occasionally get called a self-hating Jew, and like, that's never bothered me. I remember Marty Peretz writing about me that whenever you want to find a Jewish fraud, you'll find them quoting Abraham Joshua Heschel, who I love and would quote. Like I remember that whole thing, and I was I was younger and less secure in my career back then, but it always seemed fine. Like, I mean, like, Walter Mearsheimer really got, went through the ringer on that book. So, like, I'm not saying there was, you couldn't find a blowback, and I take your point that I have some kind of some armor from actually being Jewish, but it never felt to me scary. It began to feel useless, right? In a way that like what was happening there seemed so different. It seemed like it was moving and collapsing so fast that I just was too far from it to understand it well.
Yeah,
and like that was part of the feeling of it, right? Mm-hmm. I couldn't do it well.
Yeah, I think that's true. Although I will just say, I mean, and you're totally right. I mean, obviously, you read about a whole range of issues at a very high level. But I also think that one of the problems of this discourse is that I think the people who do write it a lot about it a lot, people often think they know more than – they assume those people know more than they do
because
they
write
a lot
of –
Right. It's actually like I think it would – you know, if you needed to get up to speed on something, I think it would take you literally a number of hours to basically get to know as much as a lot of the people who write about this all the time who tend to be more on the political right.
But I want to connect it back to sort of the beginning of the conversation because this is a place where I've begun to sort of re-engage with it, which is on the one hand, I feel very – increasingly alienated from Israel as a political entity. On the other hand, you know, like I don't feel able to, not that I'd want to deny it, like I cannot help but see like what is happening in Europe, which is unnerving. And now increasingly what's happening in America. And, you know, if you had taken, you know, go back a couple months, it's like, okay, there are some assholes on the internet. There are always assholes on the internet. Like, how do you really weight that? Like, I don't look at my Twitter mentions. I don't, you know, like I occasionally get anti-Semitic stuff. Like, it doesn't bother me that much. I'm pretty inured to that. And I get shit on such an array of levels at all times that my skin is pretty thick. But then it was the Tree of Life shooting.
Yeah.
And that feeling of watching Israel go down a path that I think is really politically dangerous and also then politically and ideologically exclusionary, while simultaneously, I at least think you're seeing enough data points to worry that things could get a lot worse in Europe and in the US are not necessarily so bad now, but if things just kept doubling every year for a couple of years.
Right. Imagine we have a financial crisis.
Imagine we have a financial crisis, right? Like you can run the story out, right, pretty easily.
Yeah.
That to me, it's like that's kind of the experience right now that I'm trying to unpack, even just unpack in myself, like the experience of being like a liberal Jew in 2018 is an experience that feels qualitatively different than being one in 2015.
Yeah, I agree. It does. And it's bewildering, you know, right, for people, you know, you're younger than me, but both of us, I think, grew up in a period where, first of all, where we felt like America was different, right? But also this era of world history was different. And it's funny, a lot of the American Jewish organization said, well, the threat of anti-Semitism now is from the left, right? Because that's the BDS movement and the, you know, and so very few people saw this coming. You know, actually Ben Shapiro, I mean, I don't praise him a lot, but Ben Shapiro actually had the honesty to say in a column a couple years ago that I was wrong. He said, I thought anti-Semitism.
You, Peter Beinart, or him, Ben Shapiro?
No, that he said he was wrong. He said, I always used to say, and the problem, anti-Semitism now is a feature of the American left, and I was wrong, you know, and he saw it directed at him. I mean, the truth is that we just are in uncharted territory in a lot of ways in, you know, in America. We don't really know where things are headed. And I guess my hope would be, first of all, partly I think the answer is obviously to ally with other vulnerable groups. I also feel like, for me, one of the really moving and like touching things, which I thought was brilliant about what the American Jewish community did in response to Pittsburgh, was this program where they basically said, the next Shabbat people should go to synagogue. Because again, and this is my own, maybe my own mishigas, my own issues, but to me, I also have this fear that people will, their Jewishness will be only defined in a negative sense by the sense that they have a sense that people don't like them, the anti-Semitism, rather than a sense that actually, you know what, like there's actually some real beauty and wisdom in this tradition. And like, I could even go to this tradition to help me figure out how to live a good life. You know, I mean, that's what, like with my own kids, like I very consciously did not want to talk to them about the Holocaust at all, but not certainly, and now they know about it. But like, I wanted just like Judaism to be a source of just like joy and beauty and wisdom. Like, so it's like, here are Jewish texts. Here's how, like, you could look at them and they could help answer questions. And like, yeah, you'll later on learn that, like, also there's anti-Semitism. But when I grew up, I felt like anti-Semitism was way too central in the definition of Jewishness for me. And it was too negative. And I just don't want this to become now, like, people become more Jewish because they feel like there's more anti-Semitism. Like, that's maybe inevitable, but like, to me, like the most tragic people in the Holocaust and in World War II were like the people who didn't actually have much of a Jewish identity, but were then forced to confront it, you know, because of genocidal anti-Semitism. Like, I want people to embrace like the positive parts of it.
That's a really interesting point, and I actually resonate to that a lot. I had the very good fortune to come of age in a moment where there was something confusing about the defensiveness of being Jewish.
Right.
Right. There was something confusing about coming of age in America in the time when I did, where anti-Semitism seemed as weak as it did, where Jews seemed to be doing as well as they were, where Israel was, while had a lot of problems with Palestinians and there was real danger, but like was a very well-supported, like strong force on the international stage. And there was this constant narrative of Jews as weak when they actually looked quite strong to me.
Absolutely.
And it was genuinely like emotionally confusing, right? And obviously I had grandparents and they grew up in World War II and they were not themselves in the Holocaust. But you know, I felt that around me. But there could be this friction between the narrative of Judaism I was given and the experience of Judaism that I had. And I don't want to say I never faced anti-Semitism because I did. Like I remember that my middle school went through a period where just people loved using the word kike. Like like I kiked you out of something. Like
unfortunate. Like,
it was – yeah. So I mean I always saw it a little bit around me, but it seemed – harmlessly transgressive and like just like people trying to be jerks as opposed to like people actually being anti-Semitic. But it wasn't until later when I got really into a lot of Jewish philosophy and sort of met some rabbis who had influenced me that I was able to get a kind of deeper appreciation of it for myself. And part of that appreciation, I think this is why some of the actions in Israel have been so so saddening to me, but why they've really just kind of like wrecked my relationship with Israel rather than my relationship with my Judaism, was that some of the relationship I developed with Judaism had to do with the relationship between Jews at different times and other dispossessed groups, right? The sort of beauty of like the way Jews interacted with the civil rights movement or other things of that nature. And so I very much take the point you're drawing out there that you don't want it to all be just this one thing. On the other hand, you know, like, how do you think it changes that if this is a time when there is a need for – I don't want to say a need for more defensiveness, but a need for attention? Because my basic theory of what's going on is that there have been a lot of – we have just a functionally stronger political system for many years than we have at this moment. And one of the things that I noticed in that is that there were a lot of views that were always well represented in the population that the two parties more or less kept a lid on. One of them was sort of anti-immigrant xenophobia.
Right.
The Republican Party was significantly more pro-immigrant than its base.
Yes.
And then another, I think, is anti-Semitism, where both parties are more pro-Israel and pro-Jewish than certainly a good segment of the country is.
Right.
And one of the things I just see is a weakening of that. Again, I'm not saying that Donald Trump is personally anti-Semitic. I actually don't think he is.
Yeah.
But he's, you know, they're definitely not making a huge effort to fight against the parts of their base that don't hold those same views. And
yeah.
And I think that's an interesting thing. The latent weakness there is deeper than I had thought it is. And as a political system weakens, I think the possibility of danger is more serious.
Right. I mean, look, this guy in Pittsburgh, he thought that Donald Trump was not anti-Semitic enough.
Yes.
Right? I mean, like, he did think that. Now, I don't see a whole spate of Republican candidates out there at the congressional or state legislative level who's decided that their political agenda is going to be to move to the more anti-Semitic place, the Donald Trump. Look, I think a lot of it is that Jewish political power and Jewish whiteness insulates Jews to some degree from some of this stuff. But I also think that, you know, that it's just – it's unpredictable. And the thing that I – that scares me and frustrates me is that I feel like because so much of the American Jewish political influence is focused around defending Israel from any criticism, and because the Israeli government is invested itself in downplaying Trump's complicity with anti-Semitism because they love his Israel policies, that we don't have a Jewish organizational structure that's actually combating anti-Semitism in the right way. Because combating it in the right way would require taking a harder line against what Trump is doing on a whole range of things. It would require saying, look, this caravan stuff is going to lead to anti-Semitism. We're going to oppose this kind of anti-immigrant rhetoric because we believe that as a matter of self-defense, we have to. And I think that the most powerful American Jewish organizations can't do that because they're complicit in certain – in various ways with the Trump administration.
But I'm sympathetic to the dilemma, I guess I'll say, because if I were running a big Jewish organization at this moment and I saw one of the dangers as being that – that there is more political polarization around support, certainly for Israel, if not for Jews themselves. The idea that you would pick a fight at a vulnerable moment with like one of the really powerful political coalitions when the Israeli leadership has already picked a fight with the other powerful political coalition,
right?
That would be a that would be a tough space to be. You have Israeli Jewry going to war with the Democratic Party. You have American Jewry going to war with the Republican Party.
Yeah,
like that's a strategically complex space.
Right. No, it is right. And so, right, you make a good point. From a certain perspective, one could argue, as much as I kind of loathe his value system, that Sheldon Adelson is. It's great to have Sheldon Adelson there, right? Because he has a lot of influence with Donald Trump, and he's concerned about Jews in his own particular way, and so he's gonna, you know. That's true. I mean, there is something to that. I just ultimately feel like at the end of the day, I think our best allies are going to be people who share liberal democratic values.
We've had in the last particular couple of minutes, we've had a lot of talk about political strategy for Jews. But I also just think there's a more authentic and deeper question about actual Jewishness. And at this time when there is an assault on Jews, I think being in touch with some of the things that make Jewishness strong and make it beautiful and make it enduring is important, sort of separate from the political questions, right? You were talking about how you don't want your children to only see Jewishness as defensive. You want them to be in touch with sort of what makes it remarkable. And you know, that's something that I feel too. And so whether or not it's good political strategy to be creating these sort of alliances with other folks, I think that there's something about what makes Jewishness in the long term strong, in that it's a kind of morally aspirational and admirable belief system. And I do think the degree to which that is held onto in this period is going to be important. I think if that were lost, something much more fundamental would be lost that would be of danger to Jewishness in the long run.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that one of the things I once heard a rabbi read that I thought was particularly powerful in this regard for me was this kind of question he raised about why – if you look at the arc of the Torah or the first five books of the Hebrew Bible, Abraham and then Isaac and Jacob are already in the land of Israel, right? They're where they need to be at the end, right? So why then the question do you think is massive detour, right? At least a narrative. The Jews have to – you know, Joseph has to get to slavery and sold into slavery in Egypt. The Jews have to be then oppressed in Egypt. Hundreds of years later, Moses arises. Like, why this massive detour? So this rabbi named David Silber says, well, it's because the tradition did not want – knew that Jews eventually were going to go to the land of Israel, create sovereignty in the land of Israel, eventually create kingships in the land of Israel. And they didn't want Jews to wield that power without having tasted oppression first, right? Because unless you actually have the experience of bondage, you can never rule justly. You have to always have that in the background, right? In the Navi, it says that every king, right, has to write a Torah themselves, right, to write a Sefer Torah. So they're reminded of that experience of bondage. So that thing of being reminded of that, it seems to me like – so poignant for us today because we always felt like theoretically it was good for us to be reminded of it, you know, so we'd act well. But now it also seems to me like it's also actually very, very critical to our actual safety that we remember that, because then we're able to actually form these alliances with these other people who are in distress.
So I think that's a good place to draw this to an end. Let me ask you, so I always ask some people to recommend three books here at the end. What are three you'd recommend? And I'm curious if there are any of particularly you've wanted your children to have this, to be in touch with a Jewishness that is non-defensive. Are there books in the space that do get you in touch with that, that you think let you tap into a Judaism that is about what is beautiful in it rather than what has been persecuted within it?
Yes. So, you know, one of the things that I often subject my kids to, sometimes they're more happy about it than others, is actually Jonathan Sachs's commentaries on the weekly Torah portion. So he has a book on each of the first four books of the Torah. He hasn't done Deuteronomy yet. But so right now, for instance, if you look at his book, a set of commentaries on the book of Genesis, which he calls the Genesis, the book of beginnings, they're just astonishingly, to me, I have my political problems with John Sachs. He's a little too much of a David Brooksian kind of politically, but like he has an incredible ability to draw meaning out of texts that I think are connected to people's lives. You know, for instance, he writes right now in the Torah, you're reading about the life of Jacob, you know, which is like, and one of the things that's incredible about the life of Jacob that he draws out is something that I have felt much more strongly now that I have kids, is that one of the crazy things I find about having kids and then being kind of in this multi-generational thing is you see the way things pass down from generation to generation. Even things that you thought were buried in a previous generation or certain kind of weird personality behaviors or predilections or whatever, you know, they just come back generation after generation, like out of nowhere. You're like, oh my gosh, this thing. Yeah, I know where this thing comes from. It's like uncle, you know, so-and-so. And like that's the life of Jacob. Like his mother tricks his father to give him the birthright. And then Jacob's entire, what happens at the end of, when Jacob's an adult, his own children trick him, right? When they say that Joseph was killed by a wild animal. Like this theme of deception is like runs throughout the entire course of his life. And Sachs like really unpacks that really beautifully. So that's one thing that I really, really like. I mean, there are other people whose commentaries on that. Rabbi Shaihel at Hadar is like really, really, also really, really beautiful kind of interpretations of Torah. So I would say that's probably the thing that immediately comes to mind. In terms of other books, I do think, I don't know, should I stick on the Jewish theme or just
you can whatever? Do whatever you want.
Since you mentioned Heschel, I mean, I think that the Kaplan's biography of Heschel called Spiritual Radical does really do a wonderful job, I think, of capturing him. And like, it has this amazing vignette where, you know, Heschel comes to the United States in the late 30s. He's from a Hasidic dynasty. Like, he has no, and doesn't know anything about America at all. And there's this story that like, he gets literally comes to New York and he sees a black man shining a white man's shoes. And he's like, oh, that's what happens in America. I get it. Like, I know this story. Like, just this very powerful connection from a guy who didn't know from nothing, like about African Americans or whatever. So I love that too. Anyway, another, I guess a book that I've been thinking about more recently that I read a long time ago is Czesław Miłosz's book, The Captive Mind, which is a book, I think, written in 1951. You'll understand why. It's basically about a series of characters, although he doesn't name them, and it's about how they respond to the emergence of totalitarianism and how their personality characteristics that are latent within them emerge in response to the fact that they're no longer in a free society. Anyway, it's something I think about a lot when I look at certain conservative politicians and intellectuals.
And I'm just going to take the opportunity and add one book in from Heschel, which is just The Sabbath, mm-hmm. which is just one of my favorite books. And I talk a lot on this show about time and about attention. And there's something very beautiful in that book that even if you are not Jewish, even if you do not hold the Sabbath in any kind of Jewish way, I don't think I've ever known anybody who couldn't get something out of that particular book. It's very, very short, but it's very beautiful.
Yes, yes. It's a concept that the whole world really needs, you know, especially in the age of iPhones and all that.
Peter Beinart, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you to Peter for being on the show. Thank you to all of you for listening in, to my producer, Julian Weinberger, and my engineer, Griffin Tanner. The Ezra Klein Show is a Vox Media podcast production, and we'll be back next week. How is it possible for one of the most brazen political bribery scandals in American history to play out before the country while nobody's paying attention? Bagman, a new Rachel Maddow podcast from MSNBC, goes back 45 years to dig into a story that got overshadowed in its day. It's got intrigue, corruption, envelopes of cash delivered to the White House, and of course, it's got Rachel Maddow. This is not a well-known tale, but it should be, especially today. That is, again, Bagman, an original podcast from MSNBC's Rachel Maddow. Listen for free wherever you get your podcasts or learn more at msnbc.com/bagman.
In U.S. working forests, or forest land carefully managed to provide a steady, renewable supply of wood for daily use, more than 1 billion trees are planted every year, and forestry experts protect and manage hundreds of millions of acres. Working forests have been sustainably managed for decades. How? It's simple. They plant more trees than they harvest. Learn more at workingforestsinitiative.com.